Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe from joecolantonio.com, and this is a podcast for anyone who wants to discover how to succeed with testing and automation, as well as what works for automating any software development project. But before we get into it, I just want to give a shout out to the best sponsors ever, Sauce Labs. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. Today, I'm honored to have on the show Eric Lawrence, who is the developer of Fiddler. If you're a tester, if you've been involved in testing for any amount of time or debugging web applications, you know Fiddler. So I'm really excited to have him on the show. He shares a bunch of things about Fiddler, what he's working on now, the book Debugging with Fiddler, and a whole bunch more. So check it out. Hey, Eric. Welcome to Test Talks.
Hello. Good to be here.
So before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So my name is Eric Lawrence. I graduated from the University of Maryland in 2001 and started working at Microsoft full-time. And I worked at Microsoft for just over 10 years on the Office Online team first. And then I moved over to the Internet Explorer team in 2004 and worked on Internet Explorer from 2004 until 2012. I worked on the security team and the networking team at Microsoft's IE team. And prior to that, I worked on clip art and templates and other sort of online things for the Office team. And during my career there in the Office team, you know, one of the big problems that we had was kind of debugging our clip art client and its communication with web servers. And so I started a little side project called Fiddler, which basically is an HTTP debugger that shows traffic between the client and the server. And so I did Fiddler as a side project at Microsoft from 2003 until 2012. And in 2012, Telerik approached me. They wanted to acquire Fiddler. And so they acquired Fiddler in 2012. And I moved down to Austin to join Telerik and work on Fiddler full time.
Cool. So how does that work? It's like a baseball trade or something? They go to Microsoft, say we want Fiddler and Eric thrown in?
Yeah. So it was a side project. So Microsoft didn't really have a ton of say in the matter. But certainly the fact that Microsoft was rather accommodating, they could have caused some problems if they wanted to. But they knew that this was kind of a great opportunity for me personally. And despite the fact that Fiddler wasn't a Microsoft product, certainly many people at Microsoft did use it. And I think that they recognize that, you know, Fiddler overall is good for the ecosystem and for the Microsoft platform. So they, you know, didn't raise too much of a fuss about it. Overall, I think a fairly interesting story about how kind of Fiddler developed sort of organically on the side and then eventually, you know, escaped from the Borg cube and went off as its own side thing. And so it's a story that comes up quite a bit.
Yeah, it's so cool. I can't believe you actually developed Fiddler. I mean, everyone uses it that I know of. It must be kind of surreal when you think of all the companies that actually use it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things that you would assume is that, you know, I've got a ton of awareness into such things, but the reality is I just don't. And I basically I was out at Blizzard on Tuesday, which was sort of a random coincidence. A friend of mine went to work there and, you know, mentioned that their web team uses Fiddler a bit. And, you know, if I'd like to do a tech talk there, you know, I could. And I said, well, sure, that'd be awesome. You know, I love talking to people using Fiddler. And so I got to see their campus and talk to them and things like that. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. But, you know, those opportunities actually haven't, I've been not really taking advantage of those opportunities or seeking them out that much. And so it's actually kind of constantly a surprise to find out who's using Fiddler and what they're using it for. You know, most of my visibility is when people come to me with problems and they say, hey, you know, it turns out, you know, X or Y isn't working the way we want. And, you know, I kind of find out who they are and what they're doing. And oftentimes it's super interesting. But even at Microsoft, you know, the visibility of Fiddler for a long time was not very high. And so people didn't really know who I was, certainly. And I didn't know sort of who they were and what they were doing. And that changed a little bit in 2009-ish, I think. Microsoft started an internal grassroots innovation project called The Garage. And the idea was to, you know, try and harness some of the employees' passions around software that wasn't necessarily their day job. And so one of the things that the Garage at Microsoft did was they created an internal leaderboard for applications where you could see effectively how popular your side project was within the organization. And so I did light that up in Fiddler, and the numbers were pretty staggering at some point. I looked at it, and I think it peaked at about 35,000 people inside the company had run Fiddler. And that's just utterly insane number when you consider that Microsoft is such a huge company and not everybody's even working on web software and so forth. But if you looked at the breakdown, it was tons of individual contributors. I think Test was actually the largest group by a little bit, but that's kind of misleading insofar as the Test organization at the time at Microsoft, I think, was larger than the other organizations. And then it was followed by developers and then program managers. But it went all the way up the ladder, and you know, there were vice presidents in the list of people that had been using Fiddler. And so that always gave me a little bit of a pause, because I was expecting, you know, I wasn't sure how that was going to turn out. But yeah, at some point, Ray Ozzie, who was the chief software architect of Microsoft at the time, called me on my desk phone. Wow. And asked me a question about some capture he was getting for something. And, you know, I worked on the IE team, and so we were debugging an issue with the IE using Fiddler. And I was kind of like, whoa, that's kind of fun. Certainly, I love hearing from folks who are using Fiddler and kind of spreading the word, too. Telerik has done a lot to sort of improve Fiddler's website and things like that. But as it's a product that doesn't generate revenue, you know, we basically give it away. It's not something that we spend money advertising to folks either. And so you won't see, you know, hey, get Fiddler banners on, you know, third-party websites or, you know, sponsored search placement or things like that. And so it's actually kind of fun, because you'll run into people that just have never heard of Fiddler. And when they see it, they're like, oh, man, this is actually incredibly useful. And I love that. But, you know, the one challenge for us is that, you know, there's so much focus right now on Mac as a client OS. And Fiddler currently doesn't run on Macs very well. You can run in a virtual machine, of course. And until very recently, you could run it on top Mono on Mac. But unfortunately, the latest builds of Mono, they inadvertently left out some of their code. And so the Mono team had some graphics thing. So today, I believe, even on the latest, I believe in the last two builds of Mono, Fiddler won't start. And they're going to fix that, and that'll be simple. But unfortunately, the Mono framework for WinForms, which is the UI technology behind Fiddler, is their port of that is not very good on Mac. It's actually quite nice on Linux. And so you can run Fiddler atop Mono on Linux, and you can do almost everything that you can do in the Windows version just running on Mono on Linux. But Mac is not there. And it's quite likely that we'll have to end up doing a new UI for the Mac version. And so that's something that we're kind of looking at now.
Awesome. Because I have a VM of Linux that I could put Mono on and try it. So that's awesome.
Yeah, that's one of the big things. And, you know, the nice thing about Fiddler from an architectural point of view is that it's a proxy. And what that means is that you can run it on any other machine, you can run it on a VM, and you can also debug traffic from your, you know, your iPhone or your Android or your Windows phone or your Windows RT tablet or your Chromebook. You know, a lot of those devices can't run Mono, can't run Fiddler, but they can configure their proxy settings to point at, you know, any of the desktop machines you have that are running Windows or Linux or, you know, in the future Mac. So that gives it a lot of power that you don't find in other tools where, you know, they're specific to either one browser or one platform. And so that's one of the cool things about the way Fiddler's built. It has its downsides, but it's got some upsides too.
Awesome. So I should have started it off with this question. So in a nutshell, what is Fiddler for the people that don't know?
You know, that's a great question. So I I was actually flying back from my trip on Tuesday, and you know, the guy next to me had a Windows phone, and I said, yeah, you don't see all that many of those out in the wild. And so we started a conversation. He asked what I did, and I said, well, I build Fiddler, which is, you know, it's a web proxy debugger for debugging traffic between your computer and the internet. And you know, he looked at me and waited for me to finish and says, you know, I don't understand a word you just said. And I was like, okay, let's step back a little bit. And so I noticed he was doing his email, and I said, so you're using Outlook there, right? And he's like, yeah, you know, I use Outlook. And I said, well, you know, you can think of the program that I make as kind of like Outlook for the web. But, you know, instead of showing your emails going back and forth, and so you send emails and you get emails back, and instead shows the requests that your browser sends to the web server. So, hey, Google server, please give me your homepage. And then Google sends back a homepage, and that shows up in the list of messages. And then the browser says, hey, I'd like to see the image for that homepage. And then Google server sends that back, and that also appears within the session list. And so, you know, he kind of nodded, and I think he got the general idea. And that, you know, sort of at an extremely abstract level is what Fiddler is. You know, it's actually got a bit more history in that when I was first trying to think about what I was going to do with Fiddler, my first kind of UI prototype was effectively Outlook 2000, and I guess it was XP at the time, where you've got a list of messages on the left-hand side, which looks kind of familiar, and then on the right-hand side, you've got a view that has two panes, top and bottom, and it kind of shows what those contents of those messages are when you select them. And so that's kind of where the, you know, the UX concept that persists in Fiddler today exists. Now, obviously, Fiddler has a lot of power and functionality that, you know, it's not just about displaying messages. It's about changing those messages. It's about automatically generating new responses to those messages and so forth. But, you know, at the high level, I kind of put it forth as it's a way to visualize what's going on between your browser and the internet.
Awesome. So I've used Fiddler a little bit in the past, but recently I took a course on Pluralsight with Troy Hunt. It was a security testing course.
Yep.
And he basically, the only tool he used was pretty much Fiddler. And I was just blown away by the power of just using Fiddler to actually easily find security vulnerabilities in your applications. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's Fiddler certainly. So as I mentioned, I was a security guy for many years on the browser, and you know, that's less about kind of the website security stuff, more on client security and building features for websites to opt into. But I definitely have a long background in security. The interesting aspect for Fiddler, you know, one of the very first public, you know, exposures of Fiddler in probably 2004 or 2005 that I heard about was at a security conference. An Australian government employee basically just went up on stage with Fiddler and hacked a bunch of websites. And on one hand, I thought, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I thought, oh dear God, like I'm going to get arrested in Germany or something. And so security testing and so forth is one of the scenarios that a lot of people use Fiddler for. Natively, Fiddler actually doesn't do much in the way to, you know, it visualizes things and allows you to change things. And so it's kind of the basic thing that you might use. I mean, I think you can think of it as, you know, a screwdriver or a hammer, where it's a tool that has a lot of functions, and security happens to be one of them. But there are some plugins for Fiddler that allow it to do a lot more powerful things from a security point of view. And so, for instance, there's a company called Kasaba Security, and they do web security stuff, and they've got some super smart guys who get paid tons of money to come into companies and help them secure their sites. And they liked Fiddler, and so they built an extension called Watcher that basically all it does is it's a tab that sits inside Fiddler, and you surf around your website, and it finds security bugs for you and says, hey, you know, this page is missing its character set attribute on its content type, and so you could potentially have a script injection here, or hey, this page isn't, you know, using some aspect of web security properly. So, you know, there's a missing secure attribute on a cookie, or a missing HTTP only attribute on a cookie. And so with plugins, Fiddler becomes even more powerful for, you know, whatever the scenario may be. And security is one of the big scenarios, web performance being another scenario. But that, I think, goes back to one of the other interesting aspects about Fiddler is that Fiddler from the very beginning was extensible. And it was extensible not because I'm a brilliant forward-thinking individual. It was extensible because I was building it on my own. I didn't know what people wanted to use it for. And, you know, I basically, instead of adding a bunch of functionality myself, I could put in places for people to hook their stuff in and then sort of call it a day. And that turned out to be a much better strategy. And even though I think that most people who run Fiddler are really only running my code, but the people that are most invested in Fiddler are the people who work for companies where there's specific add-ons that they've built to exercise their sites. And so, like, say, the OneDrive team at Microsoft has the OneDrive Fiddler extension that does specific things to their traffic, and it exposes specific information about their traffic and so forth. And so that's been a very productive thing.
Very cool. So I know there's a bunch of extensions for Fiddler. So what's your favorite Fiddler add-in?
You know, it fluctuates a lot depending on kind of what's going on. Certainly from a security point of view, I think Watcher is a great extension. It's one of those things. Which of your children is your favorite? But I would say at the moment, my newest child, if you will, is my favorite. So a couple of weeks ago, I mean, it was actually probably a month or two ago at this point, I started kind of looking at some websites that were much larger than they needed to be. And the reason they were much larger than they needed to be was that they were using graphics that were not properly optimized for the web. And so you'd see like a 1x1 tracking pixel that was 900 bytes. Or if you went to the Logitech homepage, the logo at the top left was a PNG file that was something like 58K. And it was this tiny little word Logitech. And so Fiddler had exposed the ability previously. If you look on the image view tab, it would tell you, you know, about how much metadata was in the image that didn't need to be there and things like that. But you had to sort of manually look for it. And, you know, I was musing on Twitter, wouldn't it be funny if, you know, Fiddler just automatically would scribble on images that had a bunch of junk in them. And so I typed that up and sent it off and didn't really think about it for about 10 minutes. And then I thought, well, actually, that would be really cool. And so what I did was I built an extension that automatically parses images. And I started with PNG files, and then I moved on to JPEGs later. And it parses the image file, finds unnecessary metadata. So that's metadata that has nothing to do with the rendering. And then it basically draws over the image in proportion to the image's amount of wastage. And so in the case of the Logitech logo, where 92% of the image actually was 92% of the bytes weren't actually used for drawing the picture, it would fill in from the bottom. And at first, you know, it was just a red fill. And then I decided it would be kind of funnier if it was like a little brick wall. And so I made it draw a little brick wall. And so with the show image bloat extension turned on, basically you can surf around the web and you'll see little brick walls anytime images are being used inefficiently. And so it's a very quick way to find things, not just on your own site. That's actually how I ended up with the Blizzard thing to begin with, was I surfed around their website, and their homepage logo at the time, the one at the top, was like 162K ping, and it was more than 50% wastage. And so I tweeted a picture of that, and my buddy from Blizzard was like, hey, that's kind of interesting. That started the conversation. But generally, like if you go to Microsoft's Surface website, for instance, the Surface team is not optimizing their images. And I probably should be a little more specific about what I mean by that. So Adobe products are among the most popular products for generating images for websites. And the challenge is that Adobe products have a mode which is like save for web, but they also frequently will use web style file formats like PNG as their native save format. And so if you use an Adobe product to save a PNG file, but you don't use save for web, all of the editing metadata that's used by Adobe's products for editing that image is stored within that PNG file as a custom data segment. And the expectation is that when you're going to publish it on your website, you use save for web and it gets rid of all of that junk. But most people say, oh, look, there's this folder full of PNG files. That's what we need for the website. And they just push it out to production. And so if you look at like the Surface website, I think it's something like two-thirds or half of their images are not optimized for web. And so the page loads a lot more slowly than it should. And the challenge, of course, is if you're sitting in Redmond on a high-speed network connection to the Redmond data center, like you're never even going to notice this. But if you're, as I was, in an airport on Tuesday that's got kind of junky Wi-Fi and it's sponsored by Microsoft Surface and you have to watch their page load over this junky Wi-Fi in order to get access to the network, you start to care a lot about how fast that page loads. And so the show image bullet extension is kind of a fun way to do that. And the thing that I've learned from people much smarter than me over the years is that in order to actually effectively change anything, you have to draw awareness to the right people. And my theory in the show image bullet extension is that the right way to solve this effectively is to make designers go crazy by drawing brick walls over their hard-drawn pictures, where they're like, oh my God, what is that? I care very much about what's getting in the way here. And so that's why I kind of made it work that way. In terms of a investment point of view, that extension is not very long. There's probably about two dozen lines of code that's related to the extension itself. And then I copied over a bunch of code that I had already elsewhere in the image view that does the analysis of, you know, is this metadata necessary for rendering the image or not? And so it's a relatively simple extension. Whereas if you look at something like Watcher, there's clearly a lot more investment and business logic in that. I think Watcher is open source, actually. And so you can actually even go look at that source directly.
It sounds like it. Like you said, Fiddler is very customizable, very open. So yep. How do you extend it normally? I believe there's something called Fiddler Script.
Yes. So the story behind Fiddler Script, you know, I mentioned earlier, it's not because I'm a genius, it's because I'm lazy. So at Microsoft, they do bug tracking in this tool called Product Studio. And prior to that, it was a tool called RAID, although they never had approval to use that name, obviously. And so, at the top of the screen for these bug trackers, effectively, there's this sea of combo boxes where you can say, like, hey, only show me bugs with the status active that are assigned to a developer and so forth. And so you have this field of combo boxes. And that was my initial thought about how you'd filter traffic with Fiddler is, you know, there'd be all these combo boxes and you do stuff. And, you know, I thought about using the WinForms designer to lay out all these combo boxes and all the corner cases and saving and loading. And I'm like, geez, this is so complicated. Like, I wish there was just really an easy way for somebody to say, you know, only show me files that are larger than 900K. And, you know, that's like basically like one line of JavaScript, you know, if body size greater than 900,000, then show, right? Wouldn't it be cool if people could just like write that line? And then, you know, I realized in sort of the Eureka moment of Fiddler, oh, well, obviously they can because .NET has this wonderful embeddable script engine. Essentially, the .NET framework has these script engines that you can use. One of the downsides or quirks of them is that the VSA, Visual Studio for Applications, I think is what that stands for, interfaces only exposed VBScript and JavaScript.NET as their languages. And so Fiddler Script is a JavaScript.NET implementation that runs inside Fiddler. And, you know, as I was explaining to somebody, it's very easy to use because it was written by somebody who didn't really quite understand what he was doing. Basically, you get a file and that file contains JavaScript methods. And those JavaScript methods are like on before requests and on before response. And inside those methods, you can just provide your own handling for, you know, what to do. And so you get passed a session object and that session object has a request object and a response object. And, you know, a request headers object and a request body object on the request object and so forth. And so you can just write very simple script to do things like add headers, remove headers, change content within bodies and so forth. And so that's all well and good. And it's quite simple to do. If you on the rules menu, you just click customize rules. You can edit your script as you see fit. And so, you know, I released that. It worked actually quite well. It's gotten a lot more powerful over the years. But then it turned out that, you know, there's some .NET programmers at Microsoft and they said, hey, you know, this JScript.NET thing is kind of weird and I don't really like it. Can I just write things in C#? And I said, well, obviously you can write things in C#. And so I created a set of interfaces for Fiddler extensions in C# as well. You know, if you were doing something like this now, you'd probably use one of the, you know, there's all sorts of toolkits and things for making scriptable and embedded code running applications today. The Managed Extensibility Framework, MEF, for instance, is what most people are using. But, you know, at the time, those things didn't exist. Fiddler was originally a .NET 1.1 product. And so MEF didn't exist. And so I wrote all my own stuff. But yeah, so you can extend Fiddler. I've got a chart in the Fiddler book that shows kind of all of the places that you can add to Fiddler. And you can add essentially new menus. You can add new columns to the session list. You can add new things to context menus. You can add new tabs, you know, and all of that. Effectively, there's almost no UI in Fiddler that's not extensible, where you can put in your own tabs and buttons and whatnot. It's not always composable. So for instance, there's currently no way that you can add a toolbar button to the existing toolbar. But, you know, there's a lot of places where you can just plug in beside normal Fiddler features. And in fact, a lot of the Fiddler features themselves are now provided by extensions. And so about half of the tabs in Fiddler are just provided by extensions that I include with the default install of Fiddler. About half of the menus in the menu items, about half of the menu items in the menus are provided by Fiddler script. And so if you just click rules, customize rules, you can go in and look at the code within that script that is providing it. And you can change it if you want.
The thing with Fiddler, it looks like you could do a lot of things with it, but when you first open it up, it could be a little bit overwhelming.
Oh, absolutely.
So my question is, why did you write Debug with Fiddler? Is that one of the reasons?
So Debugging with Fiddler is a book I wrote for a number of reasons. The precipitating event, if you will, is that prior to its acquisition, there was a different company that was looking to acquire Fiddler. And so I spent some time talking to their people who had been looking at Fiddler for a long period of time, and I watched them use it. And I was just completely horrified that people who had spent quite a bit of time looking at Fiddler, and not in a casual, hey, I'm looking to solve a problem, but rather like, hey, we might buy this thing, understood it so poorly. And so they were doing things that, you know, operations that could be take place in one click or one button press, and they were going through, you know, dozens of menus and whatnot. And I was like, oh my God, even if I don't sell this thing, I can't have people think it's this bad effectively. And so I decided, well, you know, I'm just going to start writing a book. And the book writing process was kind of an interesting one. I'd written lots of blog posts before, but nothing long form. And you know, I always had the escape hatch of, well, you know, if this thing doesn't work out, I'll just kick it up on the web as documentation for Fiddler. And so my time will never really be wasted. And so, you know, I didn't have a publisher that was on me about deadlines, but I did obviously have, you know, a real job, if you will, working in the IE team and so forth to constrain things. And I also kind of felt like, you know, I need to get this out in a relatively short term. One of the downsides, however, of trying to get this book out was turned out to take quite a bit more work than writing some other kind of book might have, because I'd think about, okay, what do I want to talk about in this book? And so I'd be like, oh, you know, here's a great topic. And I'd go off and spend a morning writing 3 to 5 pages about sort of how to do something with Fiddler. And the challenge and opportunity, I guess, of that is when you spend a bunch of time looking really closely at features and thinking about how to explain them in prose, you end up thinking about those features, you know, very carefully. And if you have the source code and understand the problem very deeply and so forth, what you end up doing is you write those 3 to 5 pages and then you realize, well, I could make a button that does this. And so you write your 3 to 5 pages, you go back to your office or your house in my case, and you spend, you know, 2 hours writing a button that does it. You're like, wow, that's awesome. That's so much better. And then you have to go delete your 3 to 5 pages because they're no longer relevant. And you just replace it with a line, push this button. And so that's something that happened throughout the process. And it turned out to be very good for Fiddler because the product got way better as a consequence. But the book took a lot longer to come out. And so I now call this, actually, I think it's a great design philosophy. I call it book-driven development, where basically when you're forced to document something, it forces you to think about it hard in ways that you might not have thought about it when you first built it. And that can result in a much better product, even if, you know, your book takes longer to come out. Yeah, that's ultimately where the Debugging with Fiddler book came from, was that process. And it's interesting because it's entirely possible that I might not be working on Fiddler here now if not for the book, because, you know, at the time that I was originally considering the sale to this other company, I had a real job at Microsoft. I was then a lead program manager, and I felt like, okay, I'm growing up, you know, my wife and I want to have a kid, I've got people that work for me, this is a side thing, I need to kind of be done with it. And in the course of writing the book, I kind of fell in love with it over again and felt like, oh man, there's actually just so much more to do. And so I ramped up my investment in Fiddler quite a bit more. And so when Telerik came along and said, hey, we want to buy Fiddler and keep you working on it, I said, wow, you know, that's actually something that I really need to consider. And so that's how I ended up kind of working on Fiddler full time. And you know, it was hard to leave the IE team, lots of brilliant, brilliant people there and lots of huge and you know, world-changing problems, but the opportunity to kind of focus on Fiddler was a great opportunity, and so I jumped at it.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to talk to you just about your experience with Microsoft, but that's a whole nother episode probably.
Yeah, I should mention, just in the sake of disclosure, I'm actually working on two books right now. I'm working on a revised edition of the Debugging with Fiddler book. So the book was originally released in June of 2012. And so it's been about 30 months now. And so I hope by the end of December to have a new edition. And so anybody that's bought the ebook in the last 6 months or so, I'll just give them a free upgrade. But that'll cover kind of the new features and the improved features since the original release of the book. But the second book I'm actually writing is called Blue Badge, and it's essentially a memoir of my time at Microsoft. And I'll talk a bit about Fiddler and how it came to be and so forth, you know, essentially how it escaped from Microsoft, if you will, and things like that. But I'll also be talking a lot about working in Office and working in Windows on Internet Explorer and sort of the people I got to interact with and the problems we had to deal with and the trade-offs we had and so forth. And so that book I was slated to be done at the end of November, and I'm way behind. And so something I'm a little panicked about at the moment, and in part because I decided to motivate myself to finish this book on time by signing up for a session at CodeMash conference that's taking place the first week of January in Sandusky, Ohio. So I proposed a talk there called Lucking In, which is basically kind of a PowerPoint style version of the book, you know, a 1 hour précis of the book, if you will. And so now I've got to do that presentation, you know, just a couple of weeks. And so I'm going to have a pretty busy next few weeks, I think.
Is there one thing you see over and over again in your experience that most people using Fiddler are doing wrong?
You know, that's a great question. I think that everybody has their own, you know, usage patterns and things that they're trying to accomplish. You know, even my focus in Fiddler has changed dramatically over the years. You know, when I first came out with Fiddler, it was for effectively debugging clip art transactions. And then we had some perf problems on the website. And so I spent a ton of time adding performance features and so forth. And many people use Fiddler for, you know, one narrow specific thing. There's people whose job it is to make sure that their Google Analytics is firing properly. And so they use Fiddler for that. And so I would say, if anything, the one thing I would see most common, or the common pattern is that a lot of people don't spend time looking at what Fiddler could help them do as well as what they're using it for. And so, you know, hey, I'm using Fiddler for security testing without thinking, hey, maybe I can do something around performance testing. Or, you know, hey, I'm using Fiddler just to verify that my web APIs are not throwing errors, without thinking of like, hey, maybe I could use it to debug my website as well. And so, you know, the pattern there, I would say, is just that people are being a little too narrow in their focus. And obviously, as with any non-trivial software, my most common feature requests are for features that are in the product. And so people will say, hey, you know, it'd be really great if I could send a request from Fiddler itself without requiring a browser or a client application. And there's a whole tab in Fiddler called Composer. Or, you know, it'd be awesome if you could add a way in Fiddler so that I could send content back that wasn't from the server, it just came from the local disk. And that's there. It's called the autoresponder. And so there's a great deal of power in Fiddler that people just haven't unlocked. And, you know, the first thing you do when you install Fiddler, you know, one of the things on the install Fiddler page is effectively like, hey, watch this quick video so that you can see the breadth of it. And it's like an 8-minute video or something. And, you know, the views on that are not anywhere near 100% of the people that download it. And so I would say, you know, probably the one mistake is people not kind of thinking broadly enough about what they might use it for and exploring that.
So I'm checking out the Telerik Is that how you pronounce it? I can never pronounce it correctly.
So that's an awesome question. Telerik was a, I believe the story, and I haven't read it since my new employee orientation, was a king in Bulgaria in like the 11th century. And so there's two pronunciations depending on, I guess, where you throw the accent. I say Telerik. The Bulgarians tend to say Tel Eric. And I like Tel Eric because my name is Eric. But it's, you know, I think most people understand an answer to both. And making things more interestingly, on Tuesday, the company was acquired by a Massachusetts software company called Progress. And so now Telerik is a Progress company. And so I get to tell people I work for Progress, which eliminates some of the pronunciation confusion. But yes.
So I was saying they actually have a pretty nice website around Fiddler.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the big things that they wanted to do, we kind of had a list of four things that we wanted to do post-acquisition, and a new website was number one on that list. The original Fiddler website, if you go back in archive.org, the Wayback Machine or whatever, and look at the Fiddler website, you might notice that it's not very good. And the story of the original Fiddler website was that in 1998, I was taking a class at my university, and we were building some sort of like online car rental system. And the original Fiddler website was an X copy of my car rental class project, and I just changed all the strings. I'm not an HTML JavaScript guy by any stretch of the imagination, and so the original website was really bad. It was actually, I guess, in some respects, a running gag. And so when I was on the IE team, my employees, in fact, would use my websites in company meetings as examples of horrible old markup they had to deal with. So, you know, my old website was a bit of a joke. And so the new website is running on Telerik Sitefinity, which is a CMS, and it's much prettier and, you know, has features that you would expect, like search and so forth, on modern websites. There's obviously more things we would like to do with the website, but, you know, it's a bit of a trade-off in that time that I'm working on website stuff. I'm not working on Fiddler proper. But yeah, it's a good way to explore around and find the stuff. And you'll find the add-ons I mentioned, for instance, on that website. So when you install Fiddler, there's an entry point into the add-ons page, and you can see all of the add-ons that are available for Fiddler. Not all of them, but the ones that have been sort of curated, all the ones I've written, and then many third-party ones.
Awesome. I don't know if you could talk about it. On the site, it lists all the key features of Fiddler. Are there any cool new features that they're working on in Fiddler that you can talk about?
Yeah, so basically Fiddler is currently at version 2.4.9.8. That's the build I'm actually currently working on. And the numbering scheme is arbitrary, but to do a proper, you know, when Telerik bought Fiddler, it was 2.3 point something. And so in 2 years, it's only incremented by 0.1. I take my points very seriously. And it's actually not necessarily for genius reasons, but Fiddler is available in two flavors, if you will. There's Fiddler 2, which runs on the .NET Framework version 2, and then Fiddler 4, which runs on the .NET Framework version 4. The two versions are effectively identical. It's just about which version they target. But that means I need to be conservative about my version numbering, because version 3 of Fiddler, it's not clear what that would even be. Because, you know, is it too revised to run on .NET 3 and whatnot? So I'm a little stingy in my version numbering. But one of the consequences is it means that, you know, for a version 2.5, wow, that's a big round number. I better be doing something special. And so I have several features that are slated for the version 2.5 release. And my goal is, in fact, to do the 2.5 release in December and do the second edition of the Fiddler book in parallel with that, so to cover the new features in 2.5, which is an extremely roundabout introduction to new features in 2.5 will include the WebSockets inspectors. Cool. And so WebSockets, HTML5 WebSockets, is a feature I first got excited about in 2001 or 2011 and started building Fiddler features for, but there wasn't a lot of interest at the time. And so I kind of held on to those. And now I'm seeing increased community interest in doing WebSocket debugging with Fiddler. And so 2.5 will include WebSocket debugging. 2.5 will also include direct filters. And so if you've ever used a tool like, you know, SysInternals Process Monitor, or, you know, before that FileMon or RegMon, users expect to be able to right click in a list view and say like, hey, don't show me this thing anymore, you know, filter this out. And Fiddler's features have always been, the filter features have always been a little bit more abstracted than that. And so doing direct filters where you just right click on something and say, don't show me this, make it go away, is something that will be in the 2.5 release. And I've got a handful of other things that are a little bit more obscure that are going to be coming for 2.5. But those are the things that hopefully we'll see this month.
Very cool. So, Eric, before we go, is there one piece of actual advice you can give someone to improve their Fiddler debugging efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
The best way to contact me is in Fiddler's help menu, click send feedback. That goes to the Fiddler inbox here at Telerik, and I read all of that every day. You can also find me on Twitter at Eric Law, but for a lot of things, it's easier to just send feedback by mail. The best way to get started with Fiddler is to watch the demo video. The best way to become an absolute expert at Fiddler is to get the book. And as I mentioned, you know, if you get the book now, I'll give you the 2.5 or the ebook now, I'll give you the second edition. Great, you can just email me. And, you know, if you're looking for sort of a more interactive Pluralsight style learning, there is actually a Fiddler specific course on Pluralsight that you can go and watch. And I believe it came out in 2013. And so it's got a lot of coverage of the vast majority of Fiddler features.
Thanks, Eric, for the awesome interview and for your Fiddler debugging awesomeness. And for links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to www.testtalks.com/31. And at the time of this recording, it's only 3 weeks away from Christmas. So if you're looking for a gift for that special test automation engineer in your life, check out Sauce Labs by clicking on the more info link on the Test Talks main page. This year, give the gift of automation awesomeness. That's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my goal is to help you succeed with test automation. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.